Welcome to the Health and Healthcare Forum. I'm Roberta Hull. Our series on health and healthcare aims to offer insights into the healthcare crisis, how it came about, and how we can solve it. We will be talking to many people who will offer their experiences and their perspectives. Some are healthcare professionals concerned with the quality of healthcare available to Americans in the early 21st century. Some are patients, and some are both. Others would like to be patients but are shut out of the system, and some are turned off. Some are academics or labor leaders or parents, but they all have stories to tell, stories with personal drama and impersonal facts. In my 30 years of teaching about the anthropology of health, I learned that when it came to discussions of past and present health, whether studied using ancient skeletal remains, worldwide databases, or observations in a modern health clinic, almost everyone finds something that resonates. We hope that this series resonates with listeners too. Today, I'm talking to Shelley Rees, an emergency room nurse with personal experiences with healthcare delivery, some good and some very bad. Shelley's had some health problems in the last, how many years would it
11.
Be? 11 years, probably traced to her work in the emergency room of a hospital. Yeah. And we're going to be talking a little bit about her personal experiences with the healthcare, but then we're going to also be talking about some general issues related to healthcare reform as well. And we'll just begin the conversation. Shelley, tell me a little bit about your work in the ER, what you did.
I was a level one trauma nurse. That's the most critical, the goriest level of trauma. I worked in the busiest ER in the country.
What was that?
It was in UC Davis, Sacramento, California, University of California at Davis. We were the busiest because we were the only level one trauma center for seven counties. And we had several major highways as well as many rivers. We were the drowning capital of the country. So
Wow. We're
lots of drowning, semi-drown or near drownings and boating accidents. And also because at the time we were one of only five ERs in the entire country that did certain kinds of injuries, like complicated neurologic injuries with a complicated major burn, that kind of thing, like plane accident, trauma, nuclear residue from potential residue from nuclear reactor sites, and certainly a lot of agricultural workers with poisonings from the pesticide and herbicide sprays. So we were in a constant state of emergency for a long time. Well, there was also a very large population of methamphetamine users and sales, and then a very large street population.
So you had all kinds of victims, healthcare situations, some involving substances that were potential contaminants to you and everybody else came in contact with them. Right. And some were just straight-out injuries from blows, trauma, accidents on the highway, et cetera, a mix of activities.
Right.
Were you working, what, was it four 12-hour shifts or 10-hour shifts? Or
12.
What were you? 12.
12-hour shifts. Uh-huh. You'd be there 13 and a half hours. Theoretically, you got an hour and a half worth of breaks. If you were lucky, you got 45 minutes. If you took that full 45 minutes, then you were really docked. Our boss would say then you weren't dedicated and wouldn't give you a raise because raises were then subjective. So you were very...
You worked very long hours for several days in a row.
Yeah, at a very fast pace.
And then you got sick.
And then I got sick.
And how did it manifest itself?
I woke up. Sometimes when you have a 24-hour flu start, you'll wake up feeling nauseous or crampy. I woke up vomiting. I went to bed well. I came home from a 12-hour shift. I worked 3 12s in a row, and I went to bed perfectly well. I was very fit. Up until that time, I was very active in the outdoors, and I woke up vomiting, was violently, violently ill with the worst 24-hour flu I've ever had. And then I couldn't get out of bed for 6 months. I was too weak to hold up a paperback book and read. I mean, I would get up and try and bathe, and that was an aerobic experience.
Wow.
It's just immediately devastated. And after 6 months, I couldn't take it anymore. I tried to go back to work, and I didn't last a week.
Oh, so it was very, very sudden. Mm-hmm. And then when you, and I assume that you sought physician's help along that six-month path,
yeah.
But what did they finally provide you with as a diagnosis?
Not much of one. The initial diagnosis was post-viral syndrome. Because I was so weak, I mean, I was, you know, I had to go and be seen by a physician after 10 days of being ill to be documented so that I could keep my job and be out ill. And my doctor said, yes, you're sick. And we did a lot of lab tests, and the only thing that came up was an elevated Epstein-Barr viral load. But, you know, a constellation of symptoms at that point, the only diagnosis that they could come up with at that time was post-viral syndrome. A year after my initial attack, I tried working and kept going out and working and collapsing again. And finally, someone said, you've got chronic fatigue syndrome. And you can't be diagnosed with chronic fatigue syndrome until you've had 6 months of disabling fatigue, debilitating fatigue.
Mm-hmm.
So with some other there's like 3 major symptoms and 8 out of 15 minor symptoms that you have to have for that
mm-hmm.
diagnosis. I was not happy about it. I was really resistant to it, but ultimately with my Epstein-Barr viral load 500% of normal and with the other symptoms, I had to finally own that I did indeed have that.
Right. And it could or possibly wasn't related to some virus that you picked up and then it elevated itself or
mm-hmm.
Became then something that wasn't a temporary but was a very long-term, a lifetime issue.
Debilitating. In Europe, there have been studies done. They have determined that it is viral. Chronic fatigue syndrome, where they call it myalgic encephalomyelitis in Europe, which I much prefer. There's a slightly derisive quality to chronic fatigue syndrome. Oh, I'm tired too. It's not about being tired. But they've determined in Europe that it is indeed a virus. It's one of the enteroviruses, which is consistent with my experience. And they find that this attaches to the muscles and makes it very difficult to contract them. So it takes a great deal more force to do a simple thing like brushing your teeth.
Interesting. That has a sense of consistency. It makes sense. Well, what I want to talk about now, what I'd like you to talk about, is how do you deal with it? This happened to you when you were, what, 45 or...
I was 48.
You were 48. You had expected to work another 15, 20 years,
at least, I'm assuming.
And so there you are, and you need to have financial support to keep you in a reasonable lifestyle.
Yeah.
Given that you couldn't work, you needed to work, and there you were, and you didn't seem to be getting better enough to be able to hold down a job.
Yeah.
What did you do?
I had a son just graduating from high school. I had not a great deal of savings. I had been working as a nurse, and I didn't have any resource. So I also had a powerful case of denial and desire to continue to work. I did try going to much smaller hospitals. I worked in one place from the busiest ER in the country. I went to an ER that had 2 beds, and we would go weeks without a patient. But I really was not able after 3 months, I wasn't able to do that. And I was in bed again for 4 weeks, or 4 months. And at the time, you know, that I was pillaging on my savings, getting my 403B accounts, which I had to then pay penalties on. But it was the only way I had to live. I had some short-term disability insurance, but I wasn't considering becoming fully disabled. Eventually, what I finally realized I had to do was I tried becoming a telephone advice nurse, where I would just sit each day, and I thought that would not be beyond my physical capabilities, and I was proven wrong.
Do you mind my asking what company you worked for?
It was part of the Sutter Health Group. I was at Palo Alto Medical Foundation at that point, just sitting in a chair, talking on the phone. It was a very high volume practice. We'd have patients waiting 30, 40 minutes to talk to us on the phone. It was still a really fast-paced thing.
And fairly stressful.
But eventually, and I did have a long-term disability insurance policy with that company, as well as a short-term. And eventually, after 18 months, I realized I was not able to continue working in any capacity. My doctor and I both agreed I was having a lot of strain symptoms, shingles outbreaks, lots of different strain symptoms that were showing up, along with a deteriorating hearing that led us both to recognize that I was no longer able to work in any capacity as a nurse. And so I left work. I had insurance for 3 months, medical insurance for 3 months, and then nothing. I had the opportunity to COBRA it. I was getting $1,400 a month from state disability. The COBRA amount for my medical insurance was $485. The two didn't mesh. I wasn't able, so I went without medical insurance. Luckily, nothing happened in that time. As a nurse, I'm able to take care of smaller things, and I didn't do any preventative things, no routine health care. And fortunately, I didn't have anything major come up. So,
but you did have some long-term disability insurance that was supposed to cover, at any rate, income.
Income. So, yes, it was supposed to cover income.
Was that with the hospital, the big ER hospital with which you worked?
No, that was from my last employer.
That was from
the Palo Alto Medical Foundation, and it was
the answering service.
Yeah,
basically
the insurance, and they actually severed their connection with that insurance company after finding they were denying policies illegally. As a matter of fact, the company was fined something like $30 or $40 million a month before they finally decided to deny my claim using the same kinds of tactics. ERISA law that my long-term disability insurance is covered under ERISA. George Bush was not the initial president to invent Orwellian terms. ERISA stands for Employee Retirement Security Income Act, which means that any benefit that you retire with from your employer can be taken away from you at any minute, and you have no recourse to get it back.
Oh, my goodness. It is Orwellian.
Yep. And you see that with pensions, but also with health insurance and long-term disability insurance. And they can just deny your claim. They can fill your chart with lies. You do not have the right. It's against the law for you to depose them. You can't directly question them. You can't take them to court. You can do nothing. All you can do is present to a judge the chart that they've filled with lies. And the judge, if there is an iota of doubt, which they've already inserted in there because of lies, then the judge has to deny your claim. That's required by law.
My goodness.
And so I suddenly found myself having only my Social Security income, which I wasn't budgeted for. I hadn't budgeted to become ill at 48.
Absolutely not. And you were able to get the Social Security claim just because you had demonstrated, which isn't very easy to do, I know, demonstrated that you needed it. I know it's very difficult for people under the age of 65 to do that, and that gives it, I would think, a fair amount of validity in itself.
That is, you know, typically it's difficult. People really have a hard time getting it, but Social Security does recognize chronic fatigue syndrome as a legitimate disease, and they do recognize the certain parameters of which, by the time I went in for my disability, I met all three of the major requirements and all 15 of the minor, and it's only you need to meet 2 and 8. I've got all the symptoms. And a doctor who saw me recognized that I wasn't trying to get something for nothing, that I was clearly ill. Can manifest it with vital signs that you can't fake. And,
I tried.
And unfortunately, this is not a disease where someone looking at me walking down the street, no one would say, oh, she's sick, she's disabled. No. You don't look sick.
So the Social Security office has developed a list that seems to work, but that doesn't mean that an insurance company or a policy will honor it. So there's a disconnect between those two categories of evidence and rights, actually.
Yeah, they have a very, the insurance company has a very different standard of being held to their contract.
Now, since all of this has happened, and in the process you've learned a great deal about how the system works and what the inadequacies of the system are, you have chosen to join up with the Mid-Willamette Valley Healthcare Advocates. What's the goal of this group that has been working here in the Mid-Willamette Valley of Oregon for, 15 years or so? What is that group trying to do, and how are you helping it?
We're trying to get to make sure that everybody has healthcare access, recognizing that it's beneficial for everyone. It is beneficial for society. My particular tactic is to try and ensure that we understand that healthcare is not a duty, it's a right. When we recognize that society benefits from having educated and healthy people, then we recognize that it is to our benefit to ensure that everyone's healthy, taken care of to the best of our possible ability. That is not a communist ideal any more than it's a communist ideal to educate our children, at least to a certain baseline competency of the, public education.
What are your goals in working with the advocates?
I think to bring a voice, because I have dealt with so many of the extremely underprivileged, the people that we don't see, our homeless population, our severely mentally ill, who are typically our homeless. Those people don't have a voice. They do have social services, but they're skimpy, they're scant, and people are desperate. They come still to the ER for minor things, because even they'll come into the emergency room by ambulance for a meal, because our social services are not meeting the needs.
We waste a lot of money helping out at the last minute and helping out in ways that probably other services can do a whole lot better, but they are not able to be brought into play.
Yeah. I had one woman come in. She'd had a lump in her breast for a little over a year.
Oh, my goodness.
It wasn't cancer, because she said, it's not because it doesn't hurt.
Oh, that was her.
And this was a woman, she was 2 weeks younger than me. She had just lost her job with the state. She had two boys, 9 and 7. This thing had just grown so much that it was getting in her way.
Oh, my goodness.
And she wanted the doctor to take it out. She looked at me and said, will I be able to take the bus home after they do this? She had metastases throughout her lungs and on her bones, and she was not going to survive 3 months, and she had no health care, and we could not initiate treatment. What we had to do is, and we did this so many times, is said, we're just going to say you came in with a cough, you're going to get Medicaid, and then we'll start treatment, but we can't start treatment for 2 weeks, and there's really nothing to do for her except, you know, keep
make her
comfortable.
Feel better.
But then she had two orphan boys. The father was dead. So, welcome to America. They could do it a lot better and a lot more cheaply. They're more talented in certain areas, certainly, than providing a warm meal in an ER. Yet we're not structured for that. What's been happening over the last 20 years is our social service, or our social safety net, as we call it generously, has been poked full of mail.
It seems that we've demonstrated in this conversation that it's not just health care that's at fault here, but our whole approach to health as a society. So I think we'll close with that, and this is our very first session on health and health care. We hope you can join us again when we have another session. Thank you. The Health and Healthcare Forum is produced by Roberta Hall and recorded by Joe Magner at Anabyte Recording Electronics in Corvallis, Oregon. Theme music composed by Laurie Childers and played by Laurie and Kent White.